You'd be surprised to know that that's the great Duke Ellington and his orchestra with Blues for New Orleans. On organ, you heard Wild Bill Davis. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead. It is Friday, June the 28th, and much to discuss today. We did have an alteration in our plans yesterday, and so we were able to defer the discussion today, and all of we are going to be talking about is the U.S. Supreme Court decisions, because we do need to catch up on these particular decisions that are so momentous. But a couple of things before we go into that discussion. The Senate voted yesterday to approve the so-called Gang of Eight's sweeping immigration reform bill. The centerpiece of the legislation is a provision that would allow an estimated 11 million undocumented immigrants living in the United States to apply for citizenship after meeting benchmarks over a 13-year period. The proposal now goes to the Republican-dominated House, and there it might encounter quite a bit of resistance. President Obama is in South Africa, and on this particular day, he is greeted with protests by students and unions that are protesting the use of armed drones against suspected Islamist insurgents, as well as other foreign policies. This is his second country in Africa that he's visiting. He was in Senegal, where he was received with a warm welcome. Things are different in South Africa with the protests, as well as being overshadowed by concerns for President Mandela's health. The surviving Boston Marathon bombing suspect, Zohar Tsarnaev, was formally indicted yesterday on 30 charges, including using weapons of mass destruction and killing 4 people. 17 of the charges released by a federal grand jury carry the possibility of the death penalty. The indictment says that Tsarnaev and his brother, Tamerlan, who died in a shootout with police, planned the attack for months after downloading bomb-making instructions from an Al-Qaeda magazine. Some of the things that are happening in our lives today. So we're waiting. I'm awaiting word that we have our guest all queued up and ready to go. And then we'll begin our program. Well, as you know, the Supreme Court made some rulings, and we are going to get into that right now. And the first leg of the rulings that we're going to be discussing is the rulings. There are 2 significant rulings on marriage equality and related ruling on Proposition 8. James Essex is the director of the American Civil Liberties Union's Lesbian, Gay, Bisexual, and Transgender Project, and he joins us now from New York. Thank you for being with us today.
Great to be with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Let's get an overview from your perspective as to the significance of the ruling and explain what exactly makes the ruling so significant.
Sure. Well, the E.D. Windsors challenged the Federal Defense of Marriage Act, and here's what DOMA meant. It required the federal government to say that even if you're a same-sex couple that is married under state law, the federal government had to say that your marriage had never happened, and to treat you as an unmarried person in each of 1,100 different contexts under federal law where it makes a difference if you're married or not. And those contexts include things like whether you can get health care for your spouse, whether you can take family medical leave to take care of your spouse if she or he is sick or dying, to get Social Security survivor benefits, veterans benefits, to be able to sponsor your spouse for a green card. In all of those contexts, the federal government said you're not a spouse, and therefore you don't get those protections. And the Supreme Court on Wednesday struck down the Defense of Marriage Act, striking it out of the federal statute books, which means that now married same-sex couples, if you're married under state law, you're married under for all those 1,100 federal purposes as well, and that's a great step forward for equality for LGBT people and equality for America as a whole.
Well, I mean, it sounds very, you know, clinical in that sense, but there's a really deep and emotional issue attached to this quest for marriage equality. And I was wondering whether, in the end, that was lost in the whole picture.
Well, it may have been lost in the way I just described it. I think it's not lost in two different contexts. One is the life story of Edie Windsor, and the other is the decision that Justice Anthony Kennedy, who wrote the majority opinion, wrote. And let me start with Justice Kennedy's opinion. Justice Kennedy's opinion focuses so much on the importance of marriage, on the dignity that marriage brings, on the significance of our relationships to each of us, and to the significance that marriage stamps on the relationship through our culture. And that was something, quite frankly, that I wasn't sure we were going to get from this court. And one of the things, part of the decision that stands out for me, is the very deep and wholehearted embrace of gay people's marriages by the majority of this court. And so there's nothing clinical about that. That is warm and fuzzy, and that recognizes the emotional significance of these relationships.
Well, I said that because there is a reference point for me in that I look at a lot of these U.S. Supreme Court rulings from a historical perspective, and I remember that there was a time, and in fact it was only up until in the 1960s, that we saw that there were laws on the books that there could not be interracial marriage. Miscegenation, as they called it, was against the law. Certain people were just prohibited from marrying certain people. So in a way, it was the progenitor of this kind of legislation, wouldn't you say?
Indeed. Look, many people draw parallels between the laws, like the laws you're talking about, that was struck down by the U.S. Supreme Court in 1967 in a wonderfully named case called Loving versus Virginia, a law that barred interracial marriage, and the laws that still exist in 37 states today that exclude same-sex couples from marriage. And I'm here as an ACLU lawyer, so I'll say that the Loving versus Virginia case in 1967 was an ACLU case, and we're enormously proud of that. And we're enormously proud to have represented Edie Windsor in getting rid of the Defense of Marriage Act this year.
Could you talk about the seminal case that was actually the case that the U.S. Supreme Court concentrated on? That's the United States versus Windsor. Who was Windsor? Miss Windsor.
So Edie Windsor is one of my heroes. Edie Windsor is just turned 84, and back in 1963, she was living in New York City and met the woman who became the love of her life, Thea Speier. And by 65, they were a couple. And in 1967, Thea proposed marriage to Edie, despite the fact that, you know, lesbians were not getting married anywhere in the world in 1967. But that's the way that they conceived of their relationship. And for the next 40 years, they lived the marriage vows, in essence, of living together in sickness and in health, because in the late 70s, Thea was diagnosed with multiple sclerosis, a disease that progressively over time paralyzed her. And so she ended up a quadriplegic. And Edie says that MS happened to both of them. And Edie cared for and loved Thea throughout that entire journey and did everything that she could to make Thea's life and their life together not be affected as much as possible by the MS. In 2007, they finally got married after a 40-year engagement. And then in 2009, Thea finally died. And what happened to Edie Windsor and the harm that DOMA caused to her is that, of course, Thea left all of their stuff to Edie, the accumulated savings of a lifetime, the apartment that they shared for decades. And Edie got socked with a $363,000 federal estate tax bill that would have been zero if their marriage had been recognized. That is, she wouldn't have had to pay any tax if she had been a straight widow instead of a lesbian widow. And she was both upset about the money and upset about the federal government saying to her that this woman that she was married to and that she had spent 44 years of her life with was a legal stranger.
Well, that was quite a victory, and it was good to see her there triumphant. It was clear that she had that story to tell and was an icon for this movement. The vote was 5-4, and it broke down pretty much along ideological lines or political lines. Could you talk a bit about the significance of that?
Sure. So you're right. It's a 5-4 decision. The four more moderate, some people say liberal members of the court voted our way. The four more conservative ones voted against us. And Justice Kennedy, who often finds himself as the swing vote, was the swing vote here and voted our way. He has become a real protector of and champion of LGBT people's rights. He wrote the other two major Supreme Court cases about the rights of LGBT people, the Lawrence versus Texas case in 2003, getting rid of the remaining criminal sodomy laws in the United States. And then in 1996, he wrote a decision called Romer versus Evans, which said that Colorado's law that banned any local non-discrimination ordinances covering and protecting gay people, that violated the federal constitution. So he has become, in his own way, a hero of the LGBT rights movement. He's not, in general, a particularly progressive guy, but he's been very, very protective of gay people, and we obviously are very thankful to him on that. But this, I mean, we've seen so many 5-4 decisions in this really momentous Supreme Court term. Just the day before the DOMA decision was issued, the court struck down a core section of the Voting Rights Act in a decision that where Kennedy was on the other side, and it is just a travesty and an awful development for America as a whole. And it's hard to see how to put these two decisions, DOMA and the Voting Rights Act, together and think that they come from the same court, because their senses and conceptions of equality seem so diametrically opposed.
Well, it was, in a way, a mixed bag, because we still had this issue of Proposition 8 dangling over people's heads. Where is that now? And could you talk a bit about the Proposition 8 factor in the Supreme Court decision?
Sure. So I'm sure folks remember that Proposition 8 was an amendment to California's state constitution that passed back in 2008 and that took away from same-sex couples the freedom to marry that had been given to them just 5 months beforehand by the California Supreme Court. This case, Hollingsworth versus Perry, was a federal constitutional challenge to Proposition 8. And whereas the issue in the DOMA case was, okay, here's a married woman who wants to have her existing marriage be recognized by the federal government. In the Prop 8 case, the plaintiffs were unmarried people who wanted to get married but were barred from getting married because of Proposition 8 and wanted the U.S. Supreme Court to say that bar on marriage violates the federal constitution. So we didn't get that ruling, but we got something that is actually enormously important anyway. The court dismissed the Hollingsworth versus Perry Prop 8 case for lack of standing. And I can go into the details of that if you're interested. But
yes, absolutely, please.
Okay. So I'll go into the details just a minute. The consequence of the ruling means that the freedom to marry is coming back, has been restored for same-sex couples in California. Because what it leaves in place is a trial court ruling from the summer of 2010 that is that there's a judgment in favor of the plaintiffs against the state of California and an order saying that same-sex couples in California get to get married. So that's a big advance for same-sex couples in California and for the country as a whole, because California is so important culturally and economically. But so the So what's the deal with this whole, so why was the case dismissed? Who was it that didn't have any standing and why didn't they? Well, here's the background. So the plaintiffs in the Perry case are two same-sex couples who, as I said earlier, aren't married but want to get married. And they sued the state of California because Proposition 8 is part of the state constitution. Well, the state of California actually agrees that Prop 8 is unconstitutional, and so it didn't defend the constitutionality of Prop 8. And because the state wasn't defending, the proponents of Prop 8, that is, the people who organized the petitions to put Prop 8 on the ballot in the first place, they intervened in the case because they care a lot about about Prop 8, and they wanted to defend its constitutionality, and the trial court let them in. So they go to trial, and the plaintiffs win, and the proponents lose. And then a funny thing happens. The state of California doesn't appeal because the state of California agrees with the judgment that was rendered against it. They think the Prop 8 shouldn't be there. They think the Prop 8 is unconstitutional. And so the only people that appeal are the proponents of Prop 8. And then they're also the only people who seek Supreme Court review. And the Supreme Court said, look, who are these people who have asked us to take this case? They are people who feel very deeply about Prop 8, so deeply that they spent many millions of dollars, $40 million, trying to get that amendment passed. But their own rights are not at stake. A core principle of the federal court system is that the federal courts will only rule on controversies that are real, where there's a real fight between people, and that the people have to be asserting their own rights, not somebody else's rights. And the court looks at this and says, look, the proponents of Prop 8, they may feel very deeply about this, but their interest in Prop 8 is no different than the interest of any voter. The people who have an interest in the case are the state, because it's a state law that's being struck down, but the state didn't want the issue before the Supreme Court. And the plaintiffs, who and other same-sex couples, because it affects whether they get to get married or not. But the straight people who put Prop 8 on the ballot, their marriages are not affected by whether gay people get to get married or not, and therefore they don't have standing to put this issue before the Supreme Court.
Now, in a way, I mean, that's a technical win, but in a way, that leads to the question of, now that we have the U.S. Supreme Court has ruled, but it seems as if it is saying that states' rights are, I mean, it's deferring back to the states, is it not? Would this now become a matter, even though the Supreme Court has ruled on it, would this now become a matter, not just Proposition 8, but even the Supreme Court ruling on DOMA, would it now become an issue for states to affirm their rights as well? Are they going to appeal? Do you expect a great deal of fuss about that?
Well, marriage has always been something that's a state issue, at least in the first instance. That is, the states have always and still get to decide the contours of who gets to get married within the confines, of course, of the restrictions in the federal constitution, like equal protection, and that equal protection was going back to the Loving versus Virginia case, striking down the interracial marriage bans. No, the state of Virginia got to decide who could get married and who couldn't, except that it couldn't discriminate based on race because the federal constitution said you can't do that. Now, we firmly believe that the U.S. Constitution also means that the states cannot exclude same-sex couples from marriage. The Supreme Court hasn't told us what it thinks about that issue yet, because it didn't tell us, neither the majority nor the dissent in the Hollingsworth versus Perry case, the Prop 8 case, told us what they think of that question. They just said, look, the issue isn't here. And sending it back to the states in Perry doesn't say this is a state issue and the federal government, the federal constitution has nothing to say about it. They simply ducked.
Yes, and that's why I'm asking the question, would there be, therefore, an anticipation of resistance, especially in those states that have not favored DOMA at all, have had a very strong opposition to same-sex marriage? Would you expect that We'll now see in light of these rulings that those states, those conservative states, would now be mounting appeals to the ruling or trying to find some ways to get around the ruling by affirming states' rights.
Yeah, well, I don't think that there's – I don't think the states that are opposed to marriage for same-sex couples are going to be bringing litigation because – here's where they stand. So there are now 29 states that have provisions in their state constitutions that exclude same-sex couples from marriage. And so until those provisions are attacked by somebody under, you know, the federal constitution, the states don't actually need to do anything more because they've done everything they can to make their values that are anti-gay discriminatory values quite clear in their state constitutions. And then there are eight other states that don't have a state constitutional amendment that excludes same-sex couples from marriage, but it has a statute. They have a statute. They have a law that says marriage is a man and a woman, and gay people can't get married. We are working to change as much of that as we can. We are working to pass more freedom to marry laws through state legislatures where we can. And where there's a state constitutional amendment that blocks our ability to have the legislature pass a marriage law, we are planning on going back to the ballot box to take some of those amendments back. And this comes in the context where we've actually been making incredible progress, both on public opinion around the issue and also in terms of the policy and laws in the various states. And just to give you an example, last November 1st, there were six states plus the District of Columbia that allowed same-sex couples to marry. And as of today, there are now 13 states plus the District of Columbia that allow same-sex couples to marry. And we made that progress. We got three more states at the ballot box last November. Voters in Maine, Maryland, and Washington State voted for the freedom to marry. And then this spring, we got three more states through state legislatures. In Rhode Island, Delaware, and Minnesota, the state legislatures passed marriage bills. The governors signed them. And then yesterday, I don't know if today's Friday, Wednesday, through the Prop 8 case, we got the freedom to marry functionally back in California, which gets us to 13. So that means that we're now at 30% of the United States population that lives in a state where same-sex couples can get married. And we were just at 11% of the U.S. population back last November 1st. So we're making a lot of progress in terms of, winning the freedom to marry in more states. And public opinion is moving with us as well. There's a poll from ABC News and Washington Post in March of this year that said that 58% of Americans nationwide support the freedom to marry for same-sex couples, which is a monumental change from where we were on the issue just 10 years ago, where we were in the high 20s in terms of support.
With the ruling, what are the states now going to do? What do they have to do to make adjustments in the way they respond to marriage licenses and so forth? Is there a timetable? Is there some kind of a period of adjustment that they have to go through?
Yeah, well, there isn't really any requirement for the states to do anything new because what we did win in Windsor affects the federal government, not the states, right? Because the win in Windsor, getting rid of the Defense of Marriage Act, doesn't mean that any new state has to allow same-sex couples to marry. Instead, what it means is that once you get married under state law, the federal government has to do something different. The federal government now has to respect and honor those marriages in all the 1,100 different contexts under federal law where it makes a difference if you're married or not. But no state has to change its law. If the Prop 8 case had been decided on its merits by the Supreme Court instead of being dismissed on standing, in that case, we either would have gotten a ruling that affected, one or some number of states or all 50 states and said you have to allow same-sex couples to marry, or we would have gotten a ruling that said that the federal constitution doesn't require states to allow same-sex couples to marry. But since the court ducked on that really important constitutional issue, all we have is the restoration of the freedom to marry for gay people in California. But not to say that that's not a big deal. It's an enormous advance for LGBT people.
So now a person, let's say a couple marrying in Boston is okay moving to Phoenix, Arizona, and still having their rights intact as of now with this ruling?
Well, very good question, and there's a somewhat unclear answer to it. So here's what is clear. If you're married in Boston, or you're married in New York, or you're married in Minneapolis, you're going to be married both for federal purposes and for all for state purposes and for all federal purposes. That's quite clear. But if you move, if you're married in Boston and then you move to Arizona, Arizona has a state constitutional amendment that says gay people can't get married. So there's no question that the state of Arizona is going to say you're not married and you're not going to get any federal benefits and obligations and protections that come with marriage under Arizona law. The question is, are you still going to be treated as married for federal purposes? And the answer is, at the moment, in some for some federal programs, yes, and for some federal programs, no. The Fed, there are two rules that the federal programs follow in order to trying to figure out whether you're married under state law. They all say if you're married under state law, you're married for federal purposes. But some of them look to the law of the state that you got married in, like in this example, Massachusetts, and others look to the law of the state that you live in this example, Arizona. We are working to convince the Obama administration, and I think they don't need a whole lot of convincing, to move as many programs as possible to the place of celebration, that is the Massachusetts rule. They're not there yet. It's going to take a little while for the Windsor decision to be implemented, but I have a lot of confidence that within, I hope, just a few months, many but not all federal programs are going to follow a rule so that if you're lived in Massachusetts and you married in Massachusetts and you moved to Arizona, you're going to continue to be considered married under federal law, even though under Arizona law you will not be treated as married at all.
Well, I want to thank you for really deconstructing this decision so that people understand it, myself included. I couldn't think of a better guide to have than you today, because you've made this complicated case very, very understandable indeed. So I want to thank you for being our guide on
Thank you very
marriage,
much.
Same-sex law. Thank you so much for being with us. We'll take this
care.
Break and then come back and talk about the other Supreme Court cases right after this. You're listening to Lead Stories on PRN.FM. I'm Eutrice Lead. And now we go to the other half of our Supreme Court deconstruction day. And our guide is our very dear friend now, because he has been doing this work for us here. I'm so very happy about it, is Gerald Hebert. We also struck gold in Gerald Hebert because he is the executive director and director of litigation at the Campaign Legal Center in Washington, D.C. For more than 20 years, he served in a number of supervisory positions with the Department of Justice and was the lead attorney in many voting rights and redistricting lawsuits, arguing several of them before the U.S. Supreme Court. He's now in private practice in Washington, D.C. Thank you, Gerald, for being with us today.
Thank you once again for having me on your show. I always enjoy your show. I learn a lot.
Me too. Thanks so much. Well, two cases that are related in a way, because they deal with people's rights, voting rights, and civil rights. And let's start with the first one, the voting rights, where your specialty is. In the case Shelby County versus Holder, the case that the U.S. Supreme Court ruled on.
Well, the Shelby County case was a case that challenged a very important provision of the Voting Rights Act. Since 1965, certain states with a long history of discrimination against black and Latino voters, in particular, have had to receive approval before they could implement any voting changes. So if they moved a polling place or redistricted the city council or the state legislature, or if they changed the hours for voter registration, any change that affected voting, they had to get pre-approval, known as pre-clearance, first. The way that the Voting Rights Act was devised in 1965 was that rather than just designate the Deep South and say, okay, these are the states that are going to have to get this pre-approval, instead the Supreme Court, Congress came up with a formula that said that if less than 50% of your voting age population in your state was registered to vote, or if less than 50% of the people who were registered actually turned out in the last presidential election, which then was 1964, then you would be covered, and you would have to be one of those states or counties that had to get pre-approval, known as pre-clearance, from either the Justice Department in Washington or a special federal court in Washington, D.C. And these provisions were very controversial from the outset, and they were immediately challenged, actually, in the U.S. Supreme Court. And in 1966, the Warren Court upheld this provision and said, yes, it's an extraordinary measure, but these are extraordinary embedded histories of discrimination. It's not going to be easy to undo. So having federal approval of voting changes is going to be ameliorative, because with each change, the Justice Department or the federal court in Washington is going to make sure that whatever change is being implemented doesn't harm minority voters. And along the way, these special provisions I mentioned in 1965 were only put into place for 5 years. When Congress looked at it again in 1970, they said these are still needed, so they extended them for 5 more years. And then in 1975, they looked at and thought whether they were still needed, and they found that there was a continuing history and ongoing discrimination against minority voters, so they extended it for 7 years. And then in 1982, they did a real comprehensive study of all these places, 16 states in all, and they said there's still very rampant discrimination going on. Some of it is more subtle now. People aren't being outright denied the right to register to vote on account of race. But every time that we see minority voters getting registered and casting ballots, we see more and more subtle and ingenious ways of trying to suppress their vote. So these special, important, extraordinary provisions of preclearance are still needed, and they extended them for 25 years until 2007. Well, that takes us forward into the post-2000 era, and in 2006, the Congress extended them again, looked at it, and compiled thousands of pages of testimony and thousands of pages of documents looking at whether or not these provisions were still needed. And what they found was that while there was a lot of improvement in many pockets, there still was pervasive discrimination in these particular 16 states. And the Congress decided to extend it for another 25 years using the same formula that had been in place since 1964. And in the interest of full disclosure, I'll say that I testified in front of Congress for that extension in 2006 and supported the extension of the act, because as somebody who has represented both civil rights groups, voting rights groups, states and counties and cities, I think I was in a pretty good position to give the Congress testimony about whether or not these provisions were still needed, and I thought they were. So then, since 2006, these provisions have been in place, and the Shelby County case was a case brought by Shelby County, Alabama, which not only has a long history of discrimination, but oddly enough, or ironically enough, actually has recent history of discrimination against minority voters. Particularly in one of their small cities within the county that actually was found to have discriminated against black voters just a few years ago. So Shelby County comes before the U.S. Supreme Court and asks that these special provisions, that history, that discrimination has long since ended, that these provisions are no longer needed, and that they're based on an outdated and outmoded formula that Congress should have changed in 2006 when they last examined it. And by a very sharply divided court, 5-4, with the Chief Justice Roberts writing the opinion for the conservative majority, they struck down these provisions. And I will just say this, Patrice, that it's not only is it an extremely act of judicial activism by the court to do this, because after all, four times in the last 45 years, four times the U.S. Supreme Court has looked at these provisions and decided they were constitutional, and now all of a sudden they aren't. In fact, just in 2009, they looked at them and decided that in 2009, when somebody challenged them as unconstitutional, they didn't declare them unconstitutional. So it was quite an extreme act, because just in recent history, there have been example after example of where when a county or a state wanted to implement some voting changes, whether it was a redistricting plan or a moving a poll in place, and they sent it in for federal approval, it was found that it was either intentionally drawn to discriminate against minority voters, or it would have that discriminatory effect, and so it was blocked. So Section 5, the preclearance provisions we're talking about, have been very important because they really freeze the status quo until preclearance is granted. You can't implement the new change. So striking down this provision, as the court did, is really going to have a significant effect, a very adverse effect on minority voters in these 16 states.
Well, the act was applicable, especially in 15 states that sought to protect the rights of minority voters in those states. And many of those states, if not most of them, are old Confederate states. So does this, in a way, does the U.S. Supreme Court ruling give new rise to a new Confederacy?
Well, you know, you make a good point here, because originally, you know, the act ended up applying to 16 states. And I should have mentioned this earlier in my description. One of the things Congress decided back in 1965 when they passed the law in the first place, they said, look, we know that this formula that we've come up with is going to include some places that shouldn't be covered, and it includes some doesn't include some places that should be covered. So they had another section of the Voting Rights Act that said, well, if you're one of these states or counties that are covered, and you think you shouldn't be covered because either you don't have this history of discrimination or you think that you've overcome this history of discrimination, you can bail out. You can exempt yourself from these provisions. And it also said that if you're a county or a state that is not subject to these preclearance provisions, but you have been found guilty of discrimination against minority voters under the Constitution, then you can be added in for preclearance. So the formula that Congress had was really what I would call a self-tailoring formula over time. And the Supreme Court upheld this formula on four different occasions since 1965 until the Shelby County case this week. Now, what is going to happen is that many of these counties and states that had to get pre-approval before they could implement changes, of course, now are going to be able to do it without having to get this pre-approval. And as a result, they're not going to automatically take into account, as they had to do until this past week, what impact these voting changes were going to have on racial and language minority citizens. And in the Deep South, yes, the South has changed, and for the better, thank goodness, but there still remains, as Congress found in 2006, not just pockets of discrimination, but pervasive discrimination that will continue. After all, we had over 100 years of deep-seated racial segregation and Jim Crow laws, and in just a couple of generations of preclearance, that wasn't going to erase that. It's going to take longer than that, but unfortunately, the Supreme Court stepped in and decided that it was not Congress's role to say when the history of discrimination ended in our nation. The Supreme Court was going to take that role, and I think it's an incredible abuse of power by the court.
Is it going to be a case that up next for basic eradication is Section 5, the preclearance section itself?
Well, there's really no need for anybody to challenge Section 5 preclearance now because the Supreme Court struck down the formula that decided who had to get preclearance. So since right now there are no jurisdictions covered that have to get preclearance, the Supreme Court, you know, it was pretty clever, actually, I think, of the Chief Justice to leave the preclearance provisions of Section 5 in place, but then to strike down the provision that decided which jurisdictions have to get preclearance. So it's, as Justice Ginsburg said in her dissent, Section 5 has really been immobilized here because there are no longer any states or political subdivisions that have to undergo preclearance under the Section 4 formula that was ruled unconstitutional. And, you know, you just had a program on moments ago about the DOMA decision, and it just struck me as incredibly ironic because in his dissent in the DOMA case, Justice Scalia just tees off on the majority for not showing deference to Congress and how dare this judiciary, which is supposed to be the weakest branch of the three of our government, really second-guessing the Congress and overruling them. And you know, Congress duly considered DOMA and decided that the Defense of Marriage Act was good policy and so on. And, you know, in DOMA, the Congress, I think they had like one day of hearings, and then they voted. And in the Voting Rights Act situation, where he strikes down what Congress did, they had hundreds of witnesses, thousands of pages of testimony that extended over a year, and he didn't show the least bit of deference to Congress in that case. So, and from one day to the next, apparently he didn't really comprehend the absurdness of his position.
Well, let's turn now to Fisher versus University of Texas at Austin, where the U.S. Supreme Court had a ruling on this affirmative action case. Fisher versus University of Texas basically was about a young woman, Ms. Fisher, who decided that she wanted to go to the University of Texas and was denied entrance, and based that she said on her race. She contended it was on her race. Could you talk about this case a bit? Because this is a puzzling case to me, because I was surprised that it actually reached the U.S. Supreme Court, since I thought she just didn't even qualify to bring the case because she didn't pass the test.
Well, I was surprised, too, that the Supreme Court took the case, but for a different reason. Just a few years ago, the Supreme Court took an affirmative action case out of the state of Michigan and ruled with respect to the University of Michigan that race could be a factor in college admissions. And the Supreme Court seemed to put some finality on the whole issue of affirmative action and using race in admissions, so long as it was just one factor of many. In Texas, of course, it was just that. And the Supreme Court in the Michigan case had kind of said that, well, we really think that, you know, probably about 25 years from now, we probably aren't going to need some of these programs, but they're still needed, and race needs to be a factor. Well, in Texas came along, and Texas's program was even more benign than Michigan's. And so when the Fisher case went up to the Supreme Court, there were many court watchers, including myself, who didn't really think the court would take the case. But lo and behold, it did. And the court really ducked the issue largely with respect to admissions in Texas for higher education. In Texas, if you are in the top 10% of your class, and they actually revised their program to say that if you were in the top 10% of your class in high school, then you were automatically eligible to get in to one of the state universities. And then they had some other criteria. And by the time you actually get down to race, whether you were, you know, and they took a whole host of factors into account. And these factors were really designed to, in the interest of having a diverse student population. And the Supreme Court in Fisher recognizes once again that this issue of achieving diversity in the college population is an important governmental interest that the state should be able to take into account. And the way that Texas had done it, it had the race of the people being like a tertiary criteria. It wasn't even primary or secondary. And so it really, when you look at diversity and you advance that as the reason, the Supreme Court in that Michigan case I mentioned had specifically held that that was an important governmental interest, and that was the interest that was being asserted here. And what the Supreme Court did in Fisher is it said, look, we've looked at the lower court's decision, and we really don't think that they applied the right legal standard in looking at this. We've said that strict scrutiny ought to apply any time there's race being considered. And, you know, arguably, I think if you look back at what the lower court had done in that case, I think they pretty much followed what the Supreme Court had said. But the Supreme Court, a majority of the justices, sent it back to the court for a reexamination. So they really punted, Utrice, on the whole issue of affirmative action. So I suspect it'll go back to the lower courts. They'll render yet another decision, and then it'll be back up before the court.
But the central question I have is, how did Ms. Fisher end up being, how did this case end up being a legitimate case? Because she did not qualify academically.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's interesting because both the Fisher case and the Shelby County case we just talked about were both cases that were instigated not by Ms. Fisher herself and not even by Shelby County itself. Instead, there's a conservative group up in Washington, D.C., that doesn't like anything that advances racial equality. And so they called up Ms. Fisher and asked her if she would be a plaintiff, and they would provide her free legal services all the way to the Supreme Court. And that same group had called Shelby County and had said, do you want to challenge the constitutionality of the Voting Rights Act? So these cases really were test cases that really were trumped up. And, you know, as somebody who's practiced law for 40 years, I know that, you know, you really can't go out and start knocking on people's doors and asking them if they want to be plaintiffs in a lawsuit. But that's pretty much what happened here. And the story never really got told in the Supreme Court that these people, whether it was the county in Shelby or whether it was Ms. Fisher herself, really didn't necessarily have that kind of injury in fact that they felt strongly enough about that they went out and hired a lawyer. They were actually recruited to bring the case. And as you point out, with respect to Fisher in particular, you know, there's arguments to be made that, you know, she met certain criteria, but she didn't certainly get the benefits of some other criteria that the University of Texas felt were important, like whether or not you've brought yourself up from the bootstraps of poverty to get into the 10% of your high school class that makes you eligible. Or maybe you come from a family where English is not the primary language spoken, but notwithstanding that, you've done really well in order to advance yourself. And, you know, universities are the stepping stone for the workplace of where people can get good-paying jobs. And that's why I think the Supreme Court in the past has recognized that that's an important governmental interest that is served by trying to have a diverse student population, and notwithstanding Ms. Fisher's arguments to the contrary.
Well, Gerald, again, thank you so much for deconstructing this. You made it very understandable, and a lot of information that you provided is information that's not out there. So I have to thank you on several counts for being with us today.
Well, thank you for having me on the show. I do hope that Congress, now that the Voting Rights Act has been struck down, its formula, will go back and in a bipartisan fashion, and I know that's rare these days, but when it comes to the Voting Rights Act, the Voting Rights Act has been the beneficiary of bipartisanship since 1965. Democrats and Republicans have come together to realize the importance of the right to vote as a fundamental right of Americans, preservative actually of all of our other civil rights. And even though, in fact, in 2006, the extension passed the Senate 98-0, and 90% in the House. And that kind of bipartisan support in 2006, just 7 years ago, hopefully we'll see some of that led by largely Republican Representative Jim Sensenbrenner, who led the charge in 2006, and hopefully will take on a leadership role now again to revise the formula in a way that will protect minority voters.
Thanks again. Thank you, Gerald, for being with us today very, very much.
Thank you. Goodbye.
Thanks. Well, we are edging toward the end of our program today, but I wanted us to get a comprehensive analysis, and I think you would agree that the information we received by those two gentlemen, by James Essex and Gerald Hebert, gave us a very strong footing on these particular decisions, which will have enormous impact on a huge population in the United States. So I'm grateful that we were just listening. It was like a class, wasn't it? But that's really what this is for, us to learn a lot about things that, you know, you read it in the newspaper, but you don't read this kind of analysis in the newspaper, that's for sure, nor from the kinds of people that we're hearing from today. So I want to thank you for that. As we come to the close of our program, I want to ask you again to just do one thing, and that is to make a phone call. We're trying desperately to get these children out of Haiti and into the homes of their relatives here in the United States. They are dying. Many of them are dying. Many of them becoming very, very ill due to all kinds of things, disease and malnutrition and just the stresses of life. Congresswoman Frederica Wilson is a pivotal person in this whole equation. She is a congresswoman whose district contains the largest number of Haitians in the United States. So we would want her to ask the president, because he apparently listens to her, to encourage the Department of Homeland Security to accelerate the Haitian family reunification plan right now. It's been approved. It's just been sitting idle there. People are trying desperately to get some kind of movement, and it's now 3 years since the earthquake in Haiti. The number to call, and I really would like you to just call respectfully and leave this message saying, we're calling to ask Congresswoman Frederica Wilson to urge President Obama to have the Department of Homeland Security expedite Haitian family reunification now. That's just all you need to say. The number is 202-225-4506. If you make that call, you'll be doing a great deal of service to people who are desperately needing help. And, you know, we have to be concerned about children. So it's about the kids. Get them in a situation where they can be taken care of by the families who are dying to have them here. And this is not costing the government any money. It's not about money at all. These people are prepared to take full responsibility for their charges. And so we need to encourage that the children be united with their families. 202-225-4506. Another thing I want to ask you to do is to begin to be an ambassador for PRN.FM and especially of this program. I need to grow this program because, as you can see, alternative sources of information are drying up rapidly. And the reasons, of course, are complex, but the fact is that that's what's happening. This is a very necessary outlet. And our aim is to grow it. Our aim is to make sure that other people know that this is where you can come. For example, you just heard these two gentlemen share some very extraordinary insights into the U.S. Supreme Court decisions. And why? Because they were a very important part of these decisions. So that kind of expertise is not routinely available anyplace else. And if it is, it is available in, you know, a number of sound bites, and that's the end of that. You would not spend a whole hour listening to people tell you what's on the inside of these things. So I ask that you join with me in being an ambassador. Tell all of your folks, people in your circle, that this is where you come to hear good stuff. All right? And have yourselves a very good weekend, a very safe and productive weekend, and we'll see each other, God willing, in the creek don't rise, as they say, on Monday. Thanks so much for being with me today.